Welcome to the Econews Report. I'm your host, Kirk Cahoon.
And I'm David Narum.
We're of Greenway Partners. And joining us in the studio today are Bill Trush, a senior river ecologist with McBain & Trush, an Arcata-based consulting firm, and Scott Greeson, who's the executive director of Friends of the Eel River. Welcome, both of you.
Hi.
Hey, guys.
All right. Well, we're here, of course, talking about the Eel River. And upcoming this Saturday is the Eel River Symposium. And I'm wondering, Scott, before we jump into the longer topics on our docket today, we want to talk just briefly about the symposium.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have planned?
Well, it's an all-day affair on Saturday. We'll start about 9:30, and the actual presentations will start at 10 o'clock, and we'll wrap up right around 5 o'clock. We will be providing a lunch for folks who pre-register, so that's the most important thing in terms of the logistics, is that people please jump on the web at eelriver.org or give us a call at 822-3342 and let us know you're coming so we can have a lunch for you. Otherwise, you might miss some of the best stuff in the day at the keynote.
Okay. And you mentioned this is at the River Lodge in Fortuna?
That's correct.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as you know, the Eel River has got a very long and tragic history, like a lot of the rivers on the North Coast and throughout the West. And I'm wondering if, Bill, if you can give us kind of a historical overview of, you know, just of the Eel River and some of the issues that face it.
Well, there's certainly a lot of issues that do face it, and they go far back. We like to think of, or we usually think about, salmon problems being fairly recent. But the hatchery woes on the Eel River go way back. And in fact, even by the 1880s, there's a recognition that the runs were in trouble. Prior to that, it was also a great dumping ground for all sorts of experiments. I think every species of catfish in the Mississippi was attempted on the Eel River.
Huh.
There was the introduction of shad. So a variety of experiments were done, as well as a declining fishery. The Eel River, though, basically has escaped damming, unlike most of the rivers. Yes, there's the Van Arsdale at the head, and it has its effect. But for a watershed its size, there's very few that have big dams on them.
Okay.
So the big issues that are really facing the eel right now, and they're not as glamorous, if you want to call fish trying to jump over a 400-foot dam glamorous, is the cumulative effects. It's the water quality. It's all the culvert crossings that prevent passage. The high turbidity, which is something that I like to focus on. Those aren't as glamorous, and they're also a lot harder to regulate. In addition, with a lot of the watershed use and illegal diversions that are going on, we're getting issues as far as temperature and just the basic ingredient stream flow. So it's kind of the classic basket case of cumulative effects. And for the resource agency at the state level and at the Fed, that's about the hardest thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a permit with a dam, but how do you regulate all of the private roads, like mine out in Fieldbrook?
Right.
There are some tremendous impacts going on there.
Bill, I imagine some of our listeners, when you mentioned one of the problems of high turbidity, had some confusion as to what that meant. Could you explain that?
Well, turbidity, we use it as a description of the clarity of the water. And it's measured by how well light passes through and is or scattered by suspended particles, sediment, or organic matter in the water. And for the fish are primarily sight predators. They need to see. And at very low levels of turbidity, cloudiness of the water, greatly impairs the fish's ability to capture prey. Also, when the water gets murky, light doesn't penetrate as well. And so the primary production, the engine of the river ecosystem, gets impaired. And those are things that have been bypassed. Those processes have not had near the attention that they need to, particularly the primary production of the river. You need algae. The invertebrates on the rocks eat the algae, and the fish eat those invertebrates. It's a pretty basic food chain.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a couple things in your introduction to the Eel River's issues, and you mentioned very briefly the Van Arsdale Dam. I'm wondering if you can give us a little more perspective on that, Scott, the Potter Valley Project.
Yeah, basically the Potter Valley Project is a couple of dams, the Cape Horn Dam and the Scott Dam, on the main stem Eel River.
And where would that be located for those of us looking at a map or imagining in our minds where this is?
They're actually in Lake County. So if you look at Ukiah on the 101 and go east of there, that's where you're going to find Lake Pillsbury up high in the High Valley in the Mendocino National Forest. The basic story there is that in the early part of the last century, 1908, I think, was when they completed the first dam, the Cape Horn Dam, which is the lower one. There was a decision taken to basically divert a significant chunk of the Upper Eel's flows into the Russian River Basin, into the East Branch of the Russian River. And this is possible because at that point, the bottom of the Eel River is about 300 feet higher than the valley floor in the adjoining Potter Valley. And so by cutting a hole through the ridge, blasting a hole through there, a tunnel through there, they're able to set up a situation where water could be pumped through the Eel River and actually gain hydropower on the other side. And then what's happened since then is that water has become sort of a key element for development in the Russian River. And for quite a long time through the 20th century, a very high proportion of the Eel River's dry season flows were pumped down the Russian River, which had some really unfortunate effects in the Russian as well. And one of our key efforts with Friends of the Eel River is to take a really hard look at the Potter Valley Project and the habitat that's been lost up above the second dam in Lake Pillsbury. And then one of the interesting points about this weekend is that this April 14th is actually 10 years to the day before the Potter Valley Project's license expires with the federal government. So we are, and that's a 50-year license, we are looking at the end game here for this big federal project. And one of the big things that citizens of the North Coast are going to need to focus on in the next 2 to 5 years is, what are the costs to the Eel River of running the Potter Valley Project, of seeing our water pumped off to the south? What are the costs of having a pike minnow factory in the upper basin, of losing the Chinook and steelhead habitat in the upper basin?
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Russian River. I think a lot of folks will be a little surprised by that. But the area that most of Sonoma County gets its water from, of course, is partly, in part at least, the Russian River. I know there's a lot of surface flows that are taken to feed water to like Healdsburg and Windsor and places like that in northern Santa Rosa. So when we talk about replacing water from the Eel River and over to the Russian River, and we say, oh, that's a problem for the Eel River and we need to do something about it, suddenly you're going to be having a much bigger social, political, economic impact outside of just the Eel River Basin if that issue is addressed. So
that's true. Yeah.
What are some strategies that we might be thinking about in advance of this 10-year deadline that's going to be an issue?
Well, one thing to start with is just that there's an assumption that's carried on for generations now that this is how things are done, and that if we were to cut off the flow of Eel River water to the Russian, it would be a disaster for the Russian River or for the wine industry. And I think that those assumptions probably no longer hold true. Many people continue to walk around with them. And some of that is because we've actually made quite a few changes on the Russian River side. They've built more reservoirs. They're much more able to be self-sufficient in terms of their water supply. Another piece, which I think Bill could probably address with more clarity than I, is that we've now become much clearer about the fact that the Russian River actually needs lower flows than it's actually had because of these Eel River diversions. That, yeah, it's been convenient to use the Russian River as basically a water conveyance ditch, but that's not actually conducive to maintaining the critically endangered salmon in the Russian River. So you put all these pieces together, and we're looking at actually, you know, trying for something more like a global fix for both systems.
Can you, Bill, address a couple things? One, the point that Scott just alluded to, but also just give us a sense of the amounts of diversion. I'm not clear on how much of the Eel's traditional run is being diverted to the Russian. Okay. Well, Scott, if you have that answer.
Okay. Well, historically, it was up to 90% of the Eel's dry season flow was actually going over to the Russian. And in the last couple of decades, we've seen that the operations of the Potter Valley Project reined in.
Well, also stressing the drainage area up there, it sounds like it's all the Eel River right. And 90% when it's only just what percent of the watershed?
Upper watershed.
Right.
Yeah, it's a small percentage. Yeah.
So historically, you know, through most of the 20th century, we saw in excess of 80% of that portion of the Eel River, that upper basin coming off of Snow Mountain, those key cold flows being diverted off into the Russian River. Under what's called a biological opinion that the National Marine Fisheries Service put together to try to protect salmon from the impacts of the Potter Valley Project, they have actually sharply reduced diversions to the Russian River. What's striking is when you look at the amount of water that's going over to the Russian River in our critically dry times, it really looks like a very high volume of water. When you talk to folks on the Potter Valley side, what they'll emphasize is that those flows are collectively just a tiny fraction of the Eel River's very large flows. And some of the point there is just that the Eel is one of the flashiest, I think is the right word. Mm-hmm. But it's a river that's had a low at times of 12 cubic feet per second at its mouth in extreme drought, to a high in the 1964 flood of in excess of 700,000 CFS. That's more than you get out of the Mississippi, you know, on an average flow. It's a huge range of flows. So if you look at the flows that are diverted as a proportion of overall winter flows, it's not much. If you look at them as against dry season flows, it's a lot.
It's all about the season in which the water is being appropriated.
Yeah, and I think really the magnitude of the flows is probably less consequential to the Eel than it is to the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, yes, they can use the water on the Russian, but how they use the water, as I said, has actually been detrimental in the past. And that's something that Friends of the Eel's looking at now, is a process in the Russian River Basin where the Sonoma County Water Agency is reexamining a state water board decision called Decision 1610, which set minimum flows in the Russian. And that's actually going to be reset at lower flows in the future. And that's a little counterintuitive, but that's actually for the benefit of salmon.
Right. Maybe you could address that a little, Bill.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive that I'm not really sure if it's the way to go. There's been a lot of bait and switch going on between the Sonoma County Water Agency and National Marine Fisheries Service, in that the flows that come from the Eel to the Russian are higher than historic during the lowest part of the year. But in the springtime, when all the smolts need lots of flow on the Russian, the flows are a lot lower than they should be.
Right.
So there's this game that's going on. And all this goes back to who wants the water and how it should be delivered. Mm-hmm. So you have to read carefully in between the lines when you see any sort of yes or no regarding flows from the Eel over into the Russian River.
Yeah. And I want to make the point that I think you guys will all acknowledge that most of our environmental problems are actually social problems in disguise. And I think water issues in the West are certainly a prime example of that. So you've listed at the beginning of the show, Bill, a number of issues that the Eel is facing. And how many of those issues, so turbidity and the ability of the river to respond quickly to storms and absorb water and, you know, flash, as you just called it, Scott, those issues seem tied very directly to land use, and especially some legacy land use like logging and like the silt that was put into the creeks and rivers and tributaries to the Eel in the 55 and 64 floods. We're probably still living with a legacy of all that sediment. So can you address that issue? How do we deal with those issues that are 50, 60 years old?
Wait. Time really is going to be the ultimate cure. There's really, we can only help the healing process so far. Mm-hmm. But clearly we need to do no more harm than we have done. But yeah, episodic events do trigger the landslides that then bleed sediment over many years and increase the turbidity. Another wild card that was inflicted on the Eel was what was then called the Sacramento squawfish and now the pike minnow. And it was voracious. I remember with my students in Garberville in the mid-90s doing a sample of fish in a big pool on the Eel River. And we took the seine nets out and we captured 700 pike minnow in this one pool. And we fin-clipped all of them, put them back in, waited a day, and then sampled another 600, a statistical way of estimating. And only 30 fish were fin-clipped. And
wow.
Yet we still caught another 600 or so fish. Oh. So picture a little steelhead smolt trying to make it through a bunch of highly predatory large fish that weren't there. And so that really has hurt the Eel also, yeah. Has been this introduction, which started at the reservoirs on the main stem Eel, brought in by one lodge. I think they traced it back to who actually brought the pike minnow in.
Wow.
So when we add introduced species, and there are other examples, with this chronic healing mm-hmm. effect that's going to, I shouldn't say the opposite there, but a healing effect that is going to take time. And it's hard to tell someone you have to replace your culvert because you're going to produce two wheelbarrows of silt. doesn't sound like very much.
Right.
But there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them.
Right.
And that's going to be difficult to do. And the regulatory system isn't geared for dealing with that.
Yeah. And I think that's the case with most environmental issues. It's if there's the big bad guy we can all go after and petition and sue, then, yeah, it's one thing. But if there's 100 little landowners out in the middle of nowhere that are contributing, as you said, sediment. Scott, anything to add?
I think what you're saying is dead on, Kirk, in terms of, you know, environmental problems being largely problems of human society. It's difficult, as you guys are saying, to solve these dispersed problems. But that's exactly why we're holding this symposium this weekend, is to help people understand, you know, what the values of the eel are, which have not been wholly lost and are susceptible to really being brought back, to build some understanding of the really significant research that's underway in the eel and some of the people who've been doing this really world-class research. You know, ultimately, to help North Coast citizens get more familiar with the frameworks for the decisions that need to be taken and with our collective responsibility. Because ultimately, if we don't together start to solve these problems, nobody's going to. Mm-hmm. I just do a little shout out for a piece that Hezekiah Allen, executive director of the Mattole Restoration Council, and I just wrote for the Trees Foundation newsletter addressing one facet of our sort of collective action problem, which is the environmental impacts on the watershed of, you know, the increase in marijuana production.
Mm-hmm.
And that presents, as we lay out in that piece, a whole host of problems that really are not easily addressed by agency action. It's going to take neighbors working with neighbors. But we need to start by understanding what's at stake. And that's a key piece of what we're trying to do with the symposium.
Right. You're listening to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host, Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners. Joining me in the studio is David Narum of Greenway Partners, Bill Trush of McBain & Trush, and Scott Greeson of Friends of the Eel River. We're talking about the Eel River and the upcoming Eel River Symposium this Saturday at the Fortuna River Lodge. Scott, you just mentioned very quickly marijuana just before we broke there, and I think that's such a big issue in Southern Humboldt, Central Humboldt, and all of Humboldt County, really. But as it pertains to the eel, what impacts to the eel are you seeing from marijuana?
Well, it's a big issue across, you know, all of Northwestern California, I think it's fair to say. And the eel basin at, you know, almost 3,700 square miles includes all of the different facets of what's really become an industry. And Hezekiah and I talk in the article I just referenced in the Trees Foundation newsletter that kind of the range of operations you're talking about, everything from the very small homestead scale grow to the incredibly large operations we've seen on the public lands, which I think are generally ascribed to drug trafficking organizations. The impacts of these operations can range from the wholesale dewatering of tributaries, large-scale poisoning of tributaries, and we're talking mostly about watershed impacts here.
Mm-hmm. These would be specific to one site that would then come down a tributary into the main stem of the eel?
Indeed.
Okay.
But it's not uncommon to see in some of the more extreme cases, these very, very large-scale grows, people who are actually mixing fertilizer in the creek, who excavate a pond out of a creek bed and then, you know, use gravity feed to pull out of there. That kind of operation can have incredibly deleterious effects, not just from nutrient loading, but often if we're using fertilizers that have a copper sulfate base, a very, very small amount of copper can have an incredibly potent effect on fish. It can basically debilitate them.
Mm.
And that's one extreme, but the unfortunate reality is that we've got a whole range of cumulatively quite significant impacts coming from much smaller operations, the homestead scale and slightly larger operations that are now quite widespread. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of those are associated with grading that's being done in a way that's really not very thoughtful and usually not permitted, but that's mm-hmm. really not the point. The point is that we're seeing an awful lot of soil released and sediment releases that, again, is coming on top of these legacy impacts. And, you know, one of the sort of strange and wonderful things about the eel is that it is probably one of the most erosive landscapes on the planet, certainly one of the most erosive landscapes in Western North America. And yet it has also been this incredibly productive, fecund fisheries river. And we have the potential here to heal the river, but we've got to stop killing it with the thousands and thousands of small cuts.
Mm-hmm. Bill, as an ecologist, following up on what Scott was just saying, if you could see one, what's your dream move moving forward to begin to heal the eel? You could take on one.
Let me see. It would have to be the cumulative effect. As much as the dam has its effect overall on the fishery, the biggest issue that covers most ground is the cumulative effect. And I would want to push for specific legislation on the cumulative effects with respect to sediment yield that would get down to addressing the cumulative rate of harvest in the forest practice rules. I've served on committees in the past, and we've identified that as a single most glaring inadequacy of the forest practice rules is addressing the cumulative rate of harvest, but also getting at the roads that are not involved in timber harvest, because they can be as bad or worse than the timber harvest itself. The best management practices that we do are good, and they've evolved over time, but the best management practices leak. You do more and more and more to a watershed, and you finally, there is a byproduct, and there's nothing you can really do to get around that. And so we have to come up and face that, CDF hasn't, and say that, no, there has to be a limit as to what you can do in a watershed, and give some clear guidelines for that. Mm-hmm. Other than that, that's what's so frustrating about the cumulative effect. What I like, one big swoop to come in and change things, the estuary. The Eel River estuary is a basket case right now in so many ways. And what we're finding out is that from the perspective of salmon and steelhead, as they swim downstream, they grow. And before, we used to think about the passage down the main stem and through the estuary as a quick trip to get to the ocean. We're beginning to understand now that without the good growth in the main stem in the estuary, we're turning out undersized fish into the ocean. Mm-hmm. Picture interior is dry, and those tributaries don't have the huge potential to produce a lot of big fish. So the journey downstream can put on another 20, 30 millimeters of growth that makes a radical difference as far as your probability of returning as an adult. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of projects getting underway for looking at the estuary.
Okay.
And so I think that's where I would focus a lot of effort would be the Eel River estuary.
And what do we see historically? Can you give folks a sense of how many fish there may have been, if we can project historically? What might have been a typical good-sized run?
Wow. You know, I don't have a number on that.
No?
Maybe
guesstimation?
Scott does. But one thing is that I was teaching a little class over in Equinox a few years ago. And people asked me, the kids asked me, why do they call it the Eel River?
I was going to ask you that, too.
And the lamprey eel was a nuisance. It was a nuisance by the old-time standards of the smell of the zillions of dead lamprey. And nowadays, they're hard to find.
Yeah.
And so it's not just about the salmon. Mm-hmm. But as far as the salmon runs go, I don't know what numbers were put out, let's say, from the 1880s and the 1890s. But there are very few fish counts also going on. Mm-hmm. Once Benbow Dam stopped in the mid-70s, really the only consistent counting was at a dam. Mm-hmm. And now there are some efforts from a variety of groups trying to instigate some sort of censusing for the future.
Yeah. And I know when we talk about historical land use, you know, I think oftentimes we're talking in our minds about folks that were here in 150, 200 years ago building dams and diverting water. But obviously the tribes have been here for thousands upon thousands of years. And I understand at the symposium that you've got Cheryl Seidner doing an invocation to the river. Scott, can you tell us a little more about your relationship with the Wiat tribe? Tribes have an historical connection and a current connection to the river. And obviously we want to include them in any thinking and planning about how to address its problems.
Yeah, and I think one of the big pieces of the, you know, how do we put the people and the river back together as a real community of life is looking to the tribes for the experience and, you know, the wisdom embedded in their cultures that they have learned from thousands of years of being part of these systems.
Well, we look at the time period in which the rivers got ruined, and it's exactly the same time period that a lot of the tribes underwent genocide. So
right.
It's not a coincidence that these things all unraveled at the same time. Generally, it was the same sets of hands doing both.
Right. Pat Higgins made an interesting point that I heard last weekend that was to the effect that if one of the key pieces of wisdom from the tribal cultures is that if you work with nature, it can produce incredible wealth, and that if you try to sort of short circuit nature, it's liable to trick you and confound your efforts. And I think one of the key points for all of the tribes, whether you're talking about the Wiat, the Bear River Band, or the Round Valley tribes, lots of tribal peoples on the Eel River, the Caddo Band and the South Fork, is that those people have a right not only to water from the eel, but to fish. And if we don't have fish runs that are really capable of being harvested in a sustainable way, we're pulling a piece out from under the possibility for those cultures to recover as well. Mm-hmm. And this is a larger theme that plays out across the entire Pacific Northwest. But I think seeing the Wiat tribe's resurgence as a people and their recovery as a culture, we're going to see an increasingly larger role from all the tribes mm-hmm. in the coming years. I want to get back to a point that you guys were making about the eel and its productivity. One of the problems in figuring out what it used to be is that most of the records that we have really come from commercial exploitation. We know that we took something like 500,000 fish out of the Eel River in the late 19th century in some years. We know that because that's how many fish were packed and sold by the canneries at the mouth of the Eel. But, you know, nobody was in here counting lamprey or, you know, censusing coho. Yeah. We know that we've lost some runs of fish almost entirely. Pink salmon probably had a spring Chinook run. So there's a huge difference between what we had here 100 years ago and what we have today.
So we're about out of time. Maybe another quick update on the upcoming symposium, the details, people, if they want to get involved.
Yeah, it's Saturday at the River Lodge, this Saturday the 14th. So you can give us a call at 822-3342 or go on the web at eelriver.org and register. And that way we may still be able to get you a lunch. But if you're in doubt, please just come. We're going to start at about 9:30, wrap up about 5 o'clock, and we've got a whole host of really impressive speakers we haven't had time to really talk about today, but people have been doing really world-class research on the ecology and geology of the eel and many of the species we've been talking about and how they respond to the Eel River's ecology.
Mm-hmm. Bill, can you reference any of those folks, the scientific?
Well, two that stand out are the ones that I know from my Berkeley days, and that's Bill Dietrich and Mary Power. Bill is a really good geomorphologist, and Mary Power is an ecologist at all scales. And they're going to be giving their perspective. And in fact, they own some property on the South Fork Eel. When I was doing my dissertation research, they wound up buying the little shack I lived in. And so they've got a vested interest in the Eel River, and I'm sure that's part of why they're coming up to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I could guarantee you'll get some good insight listening to those two.
And, you know, when you put together a conference or symposium, you generally have a takeaway goal. What's your takeaway goal for people that come to the symposium, Scott?
Well, honestly, the point here is not narrowly instrumental. We're not looking for people to immediately jump up and, you know, demand the dams be removed. It's rather really to build a base of understanding and some awareness of these larger issues so that we can move forward and really engage the dozens and hundreds of people that we're going to need to engage to address these larger problems. I mean, and as Bill was saying, it really is a combination of some big issues and hundreds and thousands of small issues that need to be addressed. And nobody's going to be able to do that on their own. We've got to all work together.
You guys don't have anything else you want to add that we missed? Or
no, I think I view the conference as thinking back to what Aldo Leopold said of having an ecological education is living in a world alone with wounds. And so I like to share that burden a little bit and let folks increase their awareness. So the next drive down to San Francisco, you start to look around a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is how the cumulative effects and some of the dam issues are going to be solved.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
This has been the EcoNews Report. I've been your host, Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners. Joining me in the studio today was David Nerum of Greenway Partners, Bill Trush of McBain & Trush, and Scott Greeson, who's Executive Director of Friends of the Eel River. We were talking about the Eel River Symposium to be held this Saturday at the Fortuna River Lodge from 9:30 to 5. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center.
Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR for the EcoNews Report.